Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Call into us today for your flu and COVID vaccines at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now we're going to talk about a new book. It's based on the archives of Grange Gorman in Dublin, the country's oldest psychiatric institution. It's just been published. It gives a profound insight into Ireland's historical attitude to people with mental illness. It's called Asylum Inside Grange Gorman, and its author, Brendan Kelly, who's Professor of Psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin, joins me now here in the studio. Brendan, you're very welcome. I'm going to start by reading out this fairly remarkable letter which you've included in the book. This is written by a woman called Jane in 1909, and she's writing to her sister Mary, who is a patient at Grange Gorman and is very ill. "My dear sister, I hear from the doctor that you cannot live long. I'm not surprised, as it was the opinion I formed of you when I saw you last August. Now, what I want to know is there anything you would like that you can't get in hospital? I mean in the way of fruit or cakes. If you will let me know, I will send you some money. I am sure any of the nurses would get anything. I will not say I am sorry you are dying. The wonder to me is you have lived so long, considering what you must have suffered in the last 10 years in poverty in Dublin. Hoping you will have a happy death, if you are not already reaping the reward of all your sufferings here. Your affectionate sister, Jane." Poor Mary. Given over to the asylum, and her sister saying that death can't really come soon enough.
Yes, Mary was admitted to Grange Gorman Mental Hospital or Asylum around 1907. She was 28 years old at the time. She had a 3-month-old baby. For 6 days, she had been refusing food, hearing voices and saying people were following her. Mm-hmm. She was admitted to the asylum, committed against her wishes to the asylum. She spent 3 years there, and like so many patients, she got TB and was dying when her sister sent her the letter that you've read out. The sister saying, you know, the suffering was such. The sister was not terribly sad. Death was on the way. When the letter arrived at the asylum, the doctors did not give the letter to Mary. They withheld it, and she died 2 days later.
Was that standard, that you wouldn't get the letter if you were there at that time?
It was standard. For this book, I looked at the archive of Grange Gorman, later known as St. Brendan's, and there are so many letters that were received from families and not passed on to patients, and perhaps even more tragically, written by patients for their families, but never posted. Mm-hmm. So this was standard practice in these very large, very custodial institutions at this time.
And the letter gives us clues, and you'll tell us about this, about Ireland's approach to mental illness at that time and over the time of Grange Gorman's existence.
So Grange Gorman was a big psychiatric hospital or mental hospital that was founded in 1810. And there are many similar around the country. So listeners will know Our Ladies in Cork, St. Bridget's and Ballinasloe. And these institutions grew almost unstoppably during the 1800s as people were admitted to them. Some people mentally ill, some people intellectually disabled, but many people who simply didn't fit in, were eccentric, were different, or sometimes no reason was given for admission. And for much of the time, admission did not need a medical certificate. So people were admitted fundamentally because they were homeless, because they were poor, or sometimes they were terminally ill and dying and sent to the asylum simply to die because there was nowhere else for them to go.
So it was the answer to every difficult question in a way. You know, what will we do with...
We have a fatal weakness for institutional answers, which feel like simple answers to complex questions here in Ireland. And the mental hospitals were the answer to almost everything. And they grew to be very large. At the early 1900s, when this patient was admitted to Grange Gorman, Ireland had around 20,000 people in our psychiatric hospitals. And that persisted right until the 1960s, 1970s. Now, to put the 20,000 in context for you, per capita, that was the highest rate of psychiatric hospitalization in the world then, before, or now. Mm-hmm. It was the most.
And the figures now for people who are in similar, equivalent institutions is what?
Well, these institutions have been largely dismantled. At this moment in time, there are approximately 2,000 people in inpatient psychiatric care in Ireland. And of those, around 1,700 are there of their own free will. So we have around 300 people who are kept under mental health legislation compared to the 20,000. And in European terms, this this is a very low number indeed. Mm-hmm. We have the third lowest number of beds in the EU now, which contrasts dramatically with what we see in the book.
So you said earlier that you didn't need to be medically certified to be admitted to one of these places. So who was making the decision?
Well, for much of the time, it was the Asylum Board, which was a group of local people. And these, of course, were susceptible to various influences. So, for example, you had a phenomenon whereby a family might have somebody who didn't fit in or was intellectually disabled. They might put them into the asylum for the winter, leave them in there, take them out at the end of the summer to work on the farm, and then put them back in. And that was called wintering in the asylum. And there are clear records of this. Now, there came a time when a medical certificate was needed for admission, but it didn't make an enormous amount of difference, if I'm honest. The numbers continued to rise even after that development.
What was the treatment like in these places?
In Ireland, we fundamentally believed in institutions, segregation as the answer. During the 20th century, a series of treatments were introduced, maybe just after Mary's time. So, for example, malaria treatment was introduced for advanced syphilis in the asylums, giving people malaria in order to cure the mental illness caused by advanced syphilis. So people brought mosquitoes to bite the patients and then treated them with quinine. And the instigator of that treatment won a Nobel Prize for it. Treatment moved on to insulin.
Do I take it that it worked because he got a Nobel Prize for it?
There is evidence that it reduced deaths from advanced syphilis, but we'll never really know because we don't see advanced syphilis in large numbers now owing to treatments.
Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. And World War One soldiers as well, many of them were placed in these institutions.
Well, that's very interesting because in the book there's a chapter about shell shock at Grange Gorman, where there was a hospital for this during the First World War. And this was very interesting because until that point, it was believed mental illness was biological. Certain people would get it, certain people wouldn't. But suddenly, the healthiest and strongest young men mainly were coming back with symptoms showing that maybe we didn't understand fully. And the outcomes were very good from spending a few weeks or a few months in the Richmond War Hospital, the shell shock hospital. The soldiers got to rest, they got pain relief, and they were treated with caffeine, which they particularly loved.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So that was a change then. So it was seen to have a function, a treatment function, as opposed to putting people away and institutionalizing them and hiding a problem.
It was a huge shift because people were discharged and these soldiers were not certified as insane in order to receive this treatment. And again, another huge, big shift. And you know, this happened on the Grange Gorman site as part of the hospital. And this history, which is explored in the book, there's a lot of work going on about it now, particularly the shell shock. If listeners are interested in the Grange Gorman Histories project, you can look up grangegormanhistories.ie because this is a very social history about an area and about a country as it changed.
Well, we need to know about this and we need to think about it because when we think about institutions at that time, we think about the Catholic Church and we think about mother and baby homes and the associated places where people were put. And we know a lot about those places, but we don't know a lot about these asylums, as they used to be called.
Well, that's right. And that's why in the book I describe this the asylums as Ireland's awkward institutions, because the church did not run them. These were non-church establishments and they were huge. So when I say there were 20,000 people in them and on a given night in the 1950s or 60s, that is more than double the number that were in industrial schools, orphanages, mother and baby homes, Magdalen laundries and prisons all put together. Now, it is correct those other institutions are interrogated and reviewed and responsibility, you know, demarcated in relation to those church institutions. But the asylums were, you know, so much bigger. And we don't have the rather convenient narrative of blaming the church as if the church was an external thing that was visited upon us rather than something we created.
And they were an important part of the economic scene then in towns around the country as well, weren't they?
Well, absolutely. When you consider the size of them. So if you take the town of Ballinasloe in the 1940s, the town had a population of 5,600 people, 5,600. Of those, 2,100 were patients in St. Bridget's. So pretty much everybody else either worked in it, had a family member working in it, or supplied it. So if you can imagine the Board of Governors or a local politician suggesting closing or even scaling it down, they would get absolutely nowhere. This was an economic powerhouse being used by communities in very subtle ways for their own needs, often at times of great difficulty, times of famine, times of poverty, but nonetheless being used for social purposes.
So there was an important change then in the 1970s, which led to their decline.
Yes. I mean, two things happened fundamentally. Effective medication was introduced for schizophrenia, and this helped in the 1960s for sure. But the biggest change, because these were social institutions, was Ireland changed. We joined the EEC in 1973. Ireland began to open up that a little bit more, and our tolerance for institutions diminished considerably. Mm-hmm. And slowly, these were dismantled. And there were some leaders in this. Professor Ivor Brown at Grange Gorman was a particular leader, but similar changes happened at the asylums around the country.
But that wasn't didn't happen at the flick of a switch, and you use that word slowly, but it's a very important word because it took a long time.
It's a very gradual process, and it should be a very gradual process. Some countries like Italy moved very, very quickly with this and really have a lot of difficulties as alternative systems, you know, cropped up and private confinement cropped up. Of course, having the third lowest number of beds in the EU now for psychiatry patients per head of population is a little problematic. We see mentally ill people who are homeless, mentally ill people in prison, and people at home who aren't treated. But when you compare that to having 20,000 people behind asylum walls, it is a degree of progress, although more needs to happen.
You're saying that we don't have the balance right then?
Look, the pendulum has swung, and as pendulums do, it has swung very much away from inpatient care, and we do need to rebalance by building up our community care structures that little bit mm-hmm. more. You know, when you look at the case history you mentioned at the start, the contrast is huge. The biggest issue today is not protection from over-exuberant care, but simply accessing services.
What do you hope will result from this book? I mean, you clearly believe that we don't consider these institutions enough as being part of our history.
These institutions are a key part of our history. And I mean, I've called the book Asylum because they did offer asylum to some people for whom there were no other options. Families were poor or unable to cope. But I'm really hopeful we will see institutions are not the answer. Large institutions simply don't work. They become focused on the institution. We've made huge progress with mental health care, and there are very good services out there, but we do need to do more in order to boost the community side of things.
Okay, well, the book is out now. As you say, it's called Asylum, Inside Grange Gorman by Professor Brendan Kelly, and we wish you well with it. Thank you very much for coming in to tell us about it, Brendan.